Support for WPR comes from Rutabaga Paddle Sports, offering canoes, kayaks, and advice for anyone wanting to experience solitude on Wisconsin waterways. 2620 Rimrock Road in Madison or rutabagashop.com.
Good morning. It's 9 minutes past 8 o'clock. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Joy Cardine this week on the Ideas Network. The Founding Fathers clearly saw a need for a free press in a democracy and wrote protections for expression and press freedom into the Bill of Rights. Let me read the First Amendment to you. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or of the right of the people to peaceably assemble, and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Well, the Founding Fathers could not, however, have foreseen the development of technologies like the Internet or the development of the so-called blogosphere. Journalists over the years have been accorded some special privileges that are not available to the rest of us. So says attorney Scott Gant, author of the book We Are All Journalists Now, published by Free Press, who will be joining us this hour to talk about this issue and his book. You can join us as well by calling 800-642-1234, toll-free, from anywhere you can hear this program. In Madison, the number is 263-1890. You can also participate online by sending an email to talk@wpr.org. And our guest this hour is Scott Gant, a partner with the law firm of Boies, Schiller and Flexner in Washington, D.C., where he practices constitutional and media law. He's also former counsel for the New Republic, and as we mentioned, is the author of We're All Journalists Now, The Transformation of the Press and Reshaping of the Law in the Internet Age. Good morning, Mr. Gant. Thank you for joining us today.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
What motivated you to write this book?
This is an issue that I've had some interest in for a number of years. I've been a news junkie as far back as I can remember. I'm in my late 30s, and I remember when I was about 10 years old, the Iranian hostage crisis ensued, and I was glued to the TV set following that story. And your listeners may remember that the genesis of the program that became Nightline actually tracked the hostage crisis every evening. And from the time I was 10 years old, I've been fascinated by news and current events. And as I became a lawyer and became interested in legal issues, in particular constitutional issues, I was always interested in the intersection of these issues, and in particular the question about whether journalists were entitled to rights and privileges that ordinary citizens were not. With the development of the Internet and the blogosphere, these issues became even more interesting, and I decided to take them up.
Well, let's talk about what those privileges are so that we can make sure we all are on the same playing field as far as knowing what the terms are. What privileges do journalists get that other people don't have access to?
Sure. It's a good question. I group the preferences that are extended to at least some journalists and not to others and certainly not to ordinary citizens into two groups. The first group are what I call access rights, and the second are special exemptions or immunity from otherwise applicable laws. The access rights are things that we're so used to that we hardly even notice them anymore. When you go into a governmental building, whether it's the Wisconsin Capitol or federal buildings, there'll be special sections dedicated to the press. The press will have special services provided to them by the government, either at those buildings or otherwise. They'll be exempt from having to pay, for instance, to get public records through Freedom of Information Act. They'll be given special access to sites, whether it's a crime scene or the ability to travel abroad to countries where citizens are otherwise prohibited from traveling, such as Iraq or to Cuba. So broadly speaking, those are what I'd refer to as the access privileges. And the other set of privileges are immunity or exemptions from laws that would otherwise apply to them and apply to other citizens. Many of these are under the umbrella of what are called shield laws, and there's been a lot of attention to those laws or the absence of a federal shield law in recent years. Many states have them by statute. Others have them through the decisions of their courts, and what they do is they allow at least certain journalists to not have to disclose information like their sources or material collected during news gathering.
But journalists can still be, if a journalist has witnessed a crime, they can be compelled to give testimony, can they not?
They can, but it all depends on what jurisdiction the event occurs in and what the forum is for attempting to coerce them to provide information. As with many things in the law, it all depends on the particular facts and the rules being applied. As a general matter, if they're just a witness, they would have to disclose what they've seen. But if they observe something in the process of carrying out their journalist activities, depending on where they are and who's trying to obtain the information from them, they may not have to disclose it.
And then there's the whole question of giving up notes, of giving up the portions of interviews that were edited out prior to broadcast and that sort of thing. I've been in broadcasting a number of years, and I know that that's an issue for people in the newsroom, and there are some pretty strict policies that most broadcasting companies have about how to give access and to what material, and when you have to call the company attorney to get a decision on something. So it's a pretty complex set of rules that journalists have to operate by in terms of how they respond to requests by government entities for pieces of information that they haven't put on the air.
Yes, absolutely. And there's been a lot of attention on this issue of shield laws in recent years because the federal government does not have one. And the result of that is because a journalist never knows whether they're going to be having federal law or a state law applied to them in a particular circumstance. When they're engaged in their journalistic activities, they have to assume that there's a good possibility that federal law rather than state law will apply, and they will not have any statutory protections to exempt them from having to disclose information about sources or information that they've developed during the news gathering process, like the notes that you referred to.
Well, two examples that I think a lot of people would recognize from names being in the news. Of course, the Valerie Plame case resulted in one journalist being incarcerated for contempt of court for refusing to give up a source for quite a while. And then there was the Josh Wolf case out in California, where prosecutors moved a case from state court to federal court precisely because California has a shield law and the federal government does not.
Yes, those are two of the cases that have received a lot of attention recently. There's another case also emanating from California having to do with the reporters who wrote for the San Francisco Chronicle and published a book regarding the steroid scandal in professional baseball. And they were sentenced. They didn't have to serve because they appealed, but they were sentenced to a considerable amount of time in jail for not disclosing their sources as well.
Well, and in that case, I think the precipitating event there was their information supposedly came from secret grand jury testimony. Wasn't that it?
That was the case, and the federal investigators and prosecutors asked them to reveal the sources of the leaked grand jury testimony, and they refused. They still refuse to this day to identify their sources, but the government believes that it identified the source and has actually charged someone with allegedly illegally leaking that information.
And again, you know, this can be a pretty fine balancing line because reporters have also been successfully sued for revealing sources when they weren't supposed to. If they had made a pledge of confidentiality to a source and then gave it up later, there was at least one case where a news organization and a reporter were successfully sued. It was in our neighboring state of Minnesota. It involved an election year news story, but still there is a fine line to walk. You make a commitment to a source to remain confidential, or you find your sources drying up. And on the other hand, you've got what seems to be, I think, a legitimate concern on the part of the government in investigating crime to have access to all the information it needs to make a case.
It's precisely this tension where you have legitimate good arguments on each side that has resulted in the absence of a federal shield law. There have been more than 100 efforts in Congress to enact a federal shield law over a period of about three decades, and we still don't have one, notwithstanding all of the attention that's been brought on this issue in recent years. The most recent efforts to revive a Shield Law initiative in Congress began with the outing of Valerie Plame Wilson. And even with that, it has still been unsuccessful. There's been a new version of a federal Shield Law proposed by several members of the House and the Senate in recent months, but the fate of that legislation remains to be seen.
Well, there are a number of things operating in various spheres here, not the least of which is the fact that, once again, technology has overtaken and far outpaced the law, as is usually the case. We've got the Internet to deal with now. I mean, in the early part of, or let's just take, go back to 1960, for example. People got their news from newspapers, magazines, radio, and television. And that was pretty much it, because that's all there was. And the people who worked for those organizations and produced the news were called journalists. And you really couldn't be one unless you got hired by one of these organizations, or you had the money to purchase your own newspaper. But today, pretty much anybody with a computer and access to the Internet can create their own website and put out what they call news.
Which is precisely why I decided to call my book We're All Journalists Now. In a sense, it might have been called We're All Journalists Again, because several hundred years ago, at the time of the founding, individuals were more or less on an equal playing field in terms of their access to other citizens to convey information and ideas to one another. One would either stand on a street corner and shout out their views or hand out a pamphlet or be able to produce, you know, a few sheets of paper and distribute them to a limited number of people. And we were more or less on an equal playing field at that point in time. During the founding and in the decades thereafter. Over the course of the last century, however, there has been a significant centralization of the means of communicating on a mass scale in the hands of a relatively limited number of people or corporations. And what has happened in the past 5 or 10 years as a result of the Internet and the widespread use of the World Wide Web, as you suggested, is that there's been an unwinding of that process and, if you will, a decentralization or democratization of the ability to communicate ideas and information to one another. And this is having a dramatic impact on our society. I think we don't fully appreciate the impact that it is having because we're living through it, and it's oftentimes difficult to have perspective when one is in the midst of a change like this, but I do believe it's dramatic and has important consequences.
We're talking about the book, We're All Journalists Now, with its author, Scott Gant, and we certainly want to let you have a chance to join in the conversation. I must admit that this is a fascinating topic for me as someone who's been interested in mass communications law and who's taught it before at the college level. I've always been interested in this, but this show isn't about me. It's about you and you making a phone call and participating in this discussion. 800-642-1234 is the toll-free number to call from anywhere you can hear this broadcast. 800-642-1234. If you're in Madison, please use 263-1890, 263-1890. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. What do you think? Do you practice internet journalism? Do you have a blog site? Do you post news and information? Maybe you have a website that's informational. Do you feel that you're just as much a journalist as I don't know, Cokie Roberts or anybody who works for NPR or any of the people who work here for Wisconsin Public Radio or someone who writes for one of the many newspapers in the country and in our state. Call us and let us know what you think. Again, 800-642-1234. I'm John Munson. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:24 on another beautiful day in the state of Wisconsin. My guest this hour is Scott Gant. He's a partner with Boies, Schiller & Flexner in Washington, D.C., where he practices constitutional and media law. He is former counsel for the New Republic and the author of the book We're All Journalists Now, The Transformation of the Press and Reshaping of the Law in the Internet Age, published by Free Press. And I will admit, for the sake of full disclosure, I did not read every word of your book, Scott. But I did read a lot of it.
Well, I appreciate that, and I hope you'll get an opportunity to take a look at the rest.
Well, I'm not giving it back.
So fair enough.
It's going to become part of my collection. Before the break, you made a really interesting point. We were talking about how technology has changed the way we look at journalism, and maybe has brought it back to what it was when anybody could post a notice on the board of their local township or something, and you could tack up some flyers and you could be the next Tom Paine. And now we've got that again, where we've got this huge place where anybody can post messages. Does this, we've had this cultural change over the past 100 years or so, where journalism has become more central. It became a profession. I spoke with some journalist friends of mine. By the way, I don't claim to be a journalist or play one on the radio, but I spoke with some professional journalist friends of mine when I knew I was going to be talking to you about your book. And I asked them, I said, well, what do you think about this? Should there be a distinction between capital J journalists who are professionals and lowercase J journalists who pretty much anybody else? And every one of them, of course, and you wouldn't be surprised at this, said, of course there should be. We have ethics, we have standards, we belong to organizations. This morning I noticed as I was walking into the studio that in the newsroom here at Wisconsin Public Radio, there's a code of ethics posted. It's a large poster. It sits in the newsroom. There's a code of journalistic ethics there. What separates, or if anything, the supposed professional journalism from everybody else?
It's important, in my view, to draw a distinction between the classifications that the government makes about the question of who's a journalist and the choices we make as individual consumers, readers, listeners. We're all entitled as individuals to make subjective judgments about what journalism we think is valuable, interesting, worthwhile. We should do that, and we do that. But the government does, from time to time, in important ways, make judgments about who's a journalist, and we discussed that at the beginning of the show today. There's a pervasive system of preferences extended to some people that the government designates as journalists, and I think there are good reasons to do that, in part because it promotes the free flow of information that we all need to make good decisions as citizens and to serve as a watchdog over the government, which is one of the vital purposes of the First Amendment. But if the government is going to make any judgments about who is a journalist, it needs to make them based on proper considerations and not on the basis of considerations that I think are inappropriate. For instance, I don't believe that the government should be making distinctions based on its view about whether a particular journalist is careful, or whether they agree with their viewpoints, or whether they're affiliated with a particular established news organization, or even whether they're engaged in their journalism activities for profit. The First Amendment was written for all of us, and technology has, in a real sense, as we've been discussing, caught up to what the First Amendment was designed to do, which was allow each and every citizen to exercise their right to share information and ideas with their fellow citizens.
And at the risk of becoming a little too esoteric, there's also a difference in terms of the law between journalism as recognized or in civil court as opposed to criminal matters. So, for example, if you sue someone for libel, if you sue a journalist for libel, that's a civil matter, and there questions of carefulness and competence and so forth actually come into play, where you're describing something that's a little different.
Yeah, there are distinctions drawn both in civil and criminal context, although in the context of libel, interestingly, the distinctions aren't as steadfast as they are in some other contexts. But going to the one of your earlier points and the comments made by some of your colleagues about journalism being a profession, I think this is an extremely important point. There are lots of journalists working for established news organizations or people who consider themselves professional journalists who are reluctant to refer to themselves as a profession. And the reason why is, although we don't know a lot about what the founders intended by including the words "or of the press" in the First Amendment, which you read at the beginning of the show. We do know that the founders, importantly, wanted to avoid a situation which occurred in England, which is that you had to get a license from the government to exercise your press rights. And many professional journalists are concerned about the idea of identifying their activities as a profession, because if you're a doctor or a lawyer, you need permission from the government to practice your craft. We don't want, and most professional journalists don't want, the government to be in that position in our country.
And I think it's also true that some bloggers don't really want to be considered journalists, and they don't want to have to deal with certain things that journalists might have to deal with, or certain other aspects of law that they might run into. For example, there's an article that I read in preparation for this interview by Jacob Weisberg, writing for Slate, who talks about some bloggers in California who had reported on some new products that Apple Computer was developing. Apple subpoenaed the bloggers, and because they said they were violating or had revealed some trade secrets, and the bloggers want to be admitted as part of the journalist class protected under the California Shield Law. But then in an altogether other case, there are cases where bloggers take the position that they're neither independent media or partisan advocates when it comes to election law, and they don't want to have to be bound by those, because they say they're part of the Internet and that shouldn't be regulated and no one should be able to tell them what to do. Are we going to have to make some sort of blanket determination here, or are we just going to be able to deal with this on a case-by-case basis?
There isn't going to be a blanket judgment made. One of the things that I try and do in the book is to explain that because non-traditional or non-professional journalists are going to play an increasingly important role in our society and a prominent role in the way we exchange information and ideas with one another, we need to recognize this fact and adjust our legal system. I say in the book that the rule book is a mess for figuring out the place of these heretofore non-journalists who are now engaged in journalism activities, to figure out what their place is in our society and how they fit into this system that we have. And those decisions are going to be made on a decentralized basis. They're going to be made at the level of local government, state government, the federal government, in all kinds of contexts. For instance, you just referred to the Federal Election Commission. And this is actually one of we were talking before about the preferences. Well, there is something called a media exemption to some of the federal election laws promulgated by the Federal Election Commission. And they provide exemptions from some of the election laws applicable to everyone else to those they designate as media. And the question of who should qualify is one that they're starting to grapple with. The other case you mentioned is a case called Apple v. Doe, or Doe v. Apple, that I discuss in the book. And that is one of what I think are going to be many cases in the years to come, which require the legal system to grapple with the question of who's a journalist in the Internet age.
The law has never outpaced technology. It's always been the other way around, and that's clearly what's happened in this case, is that the technology comes along, and then after a few years we figure out, or we try to figure out a way to regulate it, and I guess let history judge whether we were successful or not.
Yes, and we have a lot of work to do, but the reason I wrote the book is because I don't want us to be passive participants in this process. We all have an important stake in how we determine the role of these non-traditional, non-professional journalists in our society. And I would rather that we think hard and make conscious decisions and good decisions about how to answer those questions, rather than just let it unfold in an ad hoc way and then look back and then say, well, how did we do?
Should there be shield laws that apply to everyone?
I think that shield laws are valuable. Obviously, the devil is in the details. One can differ about the exact terms that should apply in a particular shield law, but in the book I do advocate the adoption of a federal shield law because of the gaping hole that exists in our system without one. I don't have a firm view on all of the elements of what that law should say, but I am adamant that it should view journalism as an activity or a function rather than on the basis of affiliation or association with an established news organization.
Our phone number is 800-642-1234. We have some open lines right now. 800-642-1234, toll free, anywhere you can hear this broadcast. 800-642-1234. 263-1890 is the number to call in Madison, 263-1890. If you'd like to send us an email with your comment on what we're discussing this hour, you can do so. The address is talk@wpr.org. Where the topic under discussion this hour is the book by Scott Gant, We're All Journalists Now, The Transformation of the Press and Reshaping of the Law in the Internet Age, published by Free Press. It's not a long book. It makes a nice read, and I recommend it to you. The print didn't hurt my eyes or anything, which is an important consideration for me.
I'm glad to hear it.
While I'm a voracious reader of books, I have a large library at home. My wife told me I'm going to have to put in another bookshelf because I'm double stacking everything. So this will add to my collection. Let me give the numbers one more time. 800-642-1234. In Madison, it's 263-1890. Well, certainly we've seen an explosion of information. People are just inundated with news. We have so many more choices that we can make today that we didn't have 20 years ago or even 10 years ago, really. And that has really, there have been some real impacts on the way that the so-called mainstream journalism community operates as well. Just ask Dan Rather.
Certainly. The world, unfortunately, seems to be divided into two camps. There are those who think that the blogosphere is a revolution, that the mainstream media is outdated, we should do away with it, and it serves no useful function anymore. And then there are those who perhaps are reflected in some of the comments of your colleagues that you mentioned, who think that the blogosphere is full of junk. It's setting us back and undermining journalism. I think that to the extent that people are in either camp, that these are too extreme. My hope is that the non-traditional or non-professional journalist who we can put under the label, generally speaking, of citizen journalist, that they will complement and help improve journalism rather than undermine it. Traditional journalism is contracting. It's shrinking. There's no doubt about that. That is due in part, but not entirely, to the proliferation of use of the Internet. The way that people get their information has changed. Readers and advertisers, including classified ads, are moving away from newspapers. People are watching less television news. But even before the Internet, traditional news organizations were shrinking, or at least some of their scope was limited. The retreat from the coverage of foreign affairs predated the widespread use of the Internet. In many areas, there is a retreat of coverage of local issues. And my hope is, so the world of journalism was changing before the Internet, and it's going to continue to change no matter what. But my hope is that this new citizen journalism movement will complement rather than undermine journalism.
Well, some would say that the Internet is the answer to the corporate journalism that's seemingly practiced so often today, which is designed to make money. I mean, newscasts have to achieve ratings, and so you put stories on that will be attractive to people, which is not necessarily the same thing as information people should be hearing. And so the drive for profits has, in some minds, has damaged the credibility of news organizations. And the answer to that is the Internet, because that's not driven by profit. And so far, everybody has equal access to that medium. And so there's the answer to that.
Certainly the charge that many traditional news organizations have conflated news and entertainment and are telling us, rather than what we should know or what's important, what titillates us. I think that's a legitimate charge, and in many ways that has predated the widespread use of the Internet. What the web does is it allows people to address issues that they don't think are getting enough attention, and it gives them a voice. This goes back to what we were discussing earlier, which is before we were all passive recipients of what established news organizations decided that we should hear. And now, if we don't like what we're hearing, either we disagree with the substance of it or things are not being covered that we believe should be, we have the opportunity, at least in a limited way, to address them ourselves.
Well, some of us are old enough to remember when Walter Cronkite was the most trusted person in America. We have some callers wanting to join us now. Let's go first to Kurt in Madison. Kurt, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning, John, and thanks for doing an excellent job covering for Joy.
Well, thank you for the comment.
I have a couple of related comments. The first is adding credibility to journalism standards for the blogosphere. Do you talk anywhere in your book, sir, about how to add more credibility in terms of citing primary sources, secondary sources? And then the related comment I have is how can we figure out who is funding what party or what journalism outlet? Because I think, where the money comes from really taints or colors the the quality and credibility of that source.
Okay. Thank you for your call and for your questions. Regarding the first issue, you raise an important and interesting question. I believe that it's essential to not view what's out there on the Internet as a monolith. And again, I think many people, particularly critics of the kind of journalism that is available from non-traditional sources, tend to lump everything together and say, oh, all of these bloggers, they're sitting around in their pajamas and they're irresponsible. Well, there is an enormous amount of variety in terms of subject matter, quality, and the nature of the undertaking out there in the world of citizen journalism. Some of it is by individuals, some of it is by groups, some of it is goes through a rigorous system of checks, and there are all kinds of interesting initiatives underway. And on that point, there are also all kinds of interesting initiatives underway where there are efforts to try and offer training and other sources of development to citizen journalists. There are initiatives in academic circles. There are initiatives being undertaken by established news organizations. There are foundations involved. There's an organization called the Knight Foundation, which is based in Florida, I believe, which has just given out millions of dollars in grants to fund these creative and seemingly responsible initiatives of citizen journalism, which are based on the Internet. So I think that there are a lot of things underway which will make these organizations or sponsors of non-traditional news more credible to many people. With respect to the second question of funding, I'm not sure I entirely understood the question. I apologize for that. But if the question is to figure out the sources of funding of traditional news organizations, most of those are owned by large corporations and I believe fund themselves, except with respect, obviously, to the advertising revenue that they generate.
Well, Kurt, are you still on the line? Why don't you give us some clarification there?
Okay. Thanks, John. I would. I guess what I'd like to see is if members in the blogosphere who are trying to gain a wider audience and more credibility in their messages, if they could disclose what financial interests, if any, they have in their organization or in their blog or in their website, so that we can actually outpace perhaps the traditional journalism outlets and say, hey, these folks over here are disclosing what their interest is. So for me, that would add more credibility to the, the content and the believability of that source if we know who's paying for it.
Thank you for that clarifying the question. I can understand why you would find that valuable, and indeed I would as well. I do know that there are lots of bloggers and citizen journalists who do that. They will have a section about their biography, and many of them will say what organizations they're affiliated with or even whether they own stock in certain companies. The non-traditional journalists should be held to the same standards as professional journalists in that regard. And at present, this is a voluntary system. But ultimately, both for traditional news outlets and for non-traditional forms of journalism, ultimately the consumers will make a judgment about whether they think the work is worthwhile and credible. And whether they make those kinds of disclosures is certainly something that people can appropriately consider in making those judgments.
We need to take a break, and we'll be right back to continue our conversation with Scott Gant, who is the author of the book, We Are All Journalists Now, The Transformation of the Press and Reshaping of the Law in the Internet Age. We're having a discussion about journalists. What makes a journalist, and what kind of protection should journalists have in our system of laws? It's a very interesting book and an interesting topic, and we have people who want to talk to us about it, but still a couple of open phone lines for you at 800-642-1234. That's a toll-free number. Or if you're in Madison, use 263-1890 on the internet, talk at WPR.org. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Joy Cardine this week on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Almost 8:47. Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up after 9 o'clock this morning on Kathleen Dunn's program, President Bush met yesterday with top Republican senators to garner support for his stalled immigration bill. After 9, Kathleen Dunn and her guests examine the significance of the bill and what it means for Congress and the 2008 presidential hopefuls. Coming up after 9 with Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network. This hour, we're discussing the book We're All Journalists Now with its author, Scott Gant, book published by Free Press, and I believe that it is available in bookstores now, is it not? The book is out, right?
It is out.
Okay.
It's certainly available from online retailers and hopefully from local bookstores.
Okay, we've got some more callers who want to get involved in our discussion, and we go next to Will in Trempealeau. Will, go ahead.
Yes, my comment has to do with the citizen journalists or non-traditional journalists, whatever term we're going to give them. One of the things that I've noticed, particularly in regard to like the sports journalism sector, is that non-traditional journalists don't often have to worry about taking a more critical stance, and that critical stance jeopardizing their access to the news. Oftentimes you'll have beat reporters in sports journalism that follow the team, and if that journalist is on the outs with the organization, that could jeopardize their access to the news. And I'll take my comments off the air.
Thank you. That's an interesting comment, and I think an insightful one that applies not just to sports journalism but to other areas as well. For instance, there has been significant criticism over the years of journalists who develop very close relationships with the subjects they cover. For instance, the repeated use of a government official as a source puts the reporter in the position of having to worry that if they say something critical about their source or something that's unhelpful to their source or displeases their source, that the source will cut them off. And again, this is one of the reasons why it is dangerous to put the government in a position of handing out preferences and privileges to journalists, is that it makes the journalist beholden potentially to the government or particular government officials, which could color the coverage. So this is a concern for traditional journalists, and in many ways non-traditional journalists are freed from it, but they might not be, depending on what their subject matter is.
Let's take another call. We'll go to Bryce in Dubuque. Bryce, good morning. Thanks for calling.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
Pretty good so far, but the day is young.
There you go. Now that's optimistic.
I keep my expectations low, and I'm hardly ever disappointed.
There you go. I've got a question for you. I own a weekly entertainment publication, and the one thing is this is a really timely subject for me because our cover story tomorrow is the fact is that we are now going to be splitting up and going biweekly on the publication, and then on the odd weeks, we're going to go strictly to an online version of our publication. And I have felt like the Internet, you know, 20 years ago when I started in this business, the Internet was not even a thought. And so it was one of those things we didn't have to compete with. Well, now it's like anybody, like you talked about journalists, is anybody can get on there. No matter how good of writers I have, somebody can get on there in an instant and write something, you know, blog something or whatever. I guess my question is this, is where do you think, say, even 2-3 years down the road from now, what kind of impact do you think the Internet is going to have on, you know, publications, not just the dailies, but publications in general? Where now, you know, even though I'm weekly and I felt like I was very timely, now people can be, you know, up to the minute with information. So even a week later seems, you know, years down the road when you compare it to the Internet.
I think the changes that are currently in place are going to continue to accelerate. One of the effects that you referred to is the acceleration of the so-called news cycle. Before, we were kind of on a 24-hour news cycle. A newspaper would come out. Some cities had a paper come out in the morning, in the afternoon, but most places it was once a day. The news came to you in 24-hour chunks. Then, with the advent of cable news, things accelerated where you were getting them more quickly. With the Internet, and I make this comment in the book, the quote-unquote news cycle has essentially disappeared. There's no cycle at all. There's only the moment. And what this does is it changes the patterns of the way we consume the news, and it's going to force news organizations or journalism outlets to rethink what they're doing and why people are coming to them, so that publications that don't have the news of the moment are going to have to offer something else rather than just the novelty or the latest information. They're going to have to offer analysis to attract their customers. But some of the other developments are that the fact that once a publication comes out, you now have thousands of readers effectively serving as fact checkers has also changed the way in which the news is produced, and in some ways for the good.
Well, there's a great example of that. Last week, I interviewed the publisher of the Duluth News Tribune and the Superior Daily Telegram, who's leaving for another job out in California, and she related the story of one of the things that's changed for them is their ability now as a newspaper to react instantly to developments that happen during the day by using their website. She, while she was speaking to the staff to tell them that she had taken a new job, one of the reporters was already putting that information onto the newspaper's website. So that's a dramatic difference, and it's one way that that some people think that newspapers are going to be able to compete because they have a staff that can go out and get the news, and they have access to information that the average person might not. But that's going to be their way to compete, is that they have content, and now they have a new channel to push it through.
The Internet certainly provides both traditional news outlets and non-traditional journalism ventures with incredibly increased capacity to distribute their information. One of my concerns is that is coming at a cost that the kind of content we're putting out there is more superficial because we're more focused on the new development at a superficial level rather than having more analysis and sober reflection. And we need both. We don't just need what's new. We need to understand what really happened and why it's important.
Well, there's the old argument is whether it's important to be first or whether it's important to be right. And a lot of people would say it's both. I mean, if you're in a competitive situation, you want to be the first one with the news. But if you're wrong, then you're liable to get, you know, killed. I mean, there'll be all sorts of repercussions for that. That doesn't seem to necessarily be true in the blogosphere. It's what can we put on right now, and we'll find out if it's right later.
Well, I think both participants in the blogosphere and traditional news organizations both have plenty of egg on their face over time in an effort to get things first.
Let's go back to the phones and take a call from Bill in Madison. Bill, good morning. Thanks for calling us.
Yes, I'm very conflicted myself. I've been convinced for years, before there was ever such a thing as a blogosphere, that basically that traditional media is no more reliable than communist era TASS or Pravda. You know, they were organs of the Soviet government system, whereas but modern American traditional journalism is corporatist, you know, a very corporatist slant. But the thing that bothers me about the blog, I mean, having said the first thing, the thing that bothers me about the blogosphere is that my sense is that there's really no pretense at a commitment to the truth. You have blogs that are blatantly, you know, right-wing, and they slant the news deliberately for that point of view, and they make no apologies for it. And you have blogs on the left that do exactly the same thing to promote their point of view, and you never get a sense that there's any commitment to the truth. And so, you know, here I'm in a quandary. I mean, yes, I'm seeing the destruction of traditional media, which in many ways I've been looking forward to for many years. On the other hand, what's replacing it is pretty scary. I'll take your reaction off the air.
Thanks for the call.
Yeah, thank you. I want to make a point, which is much has been made over the years about the idea that news must be objective in order to be news or journalism. I don't subscribe to that view, at least under a certain conception of objectivity. I think you can be have a viewpoint and still be engaged in worthwhile journalism. But what you need to be is to be rigorous and have intellectual honesty and a regard for truth, as the caller suggests, is important. So my hope would be that if there are either non-traditional or traditional news outlets that don't show a regard for the truth and are willing to manipulate facts in order to make a point, my hope would be that no one would be interested in watching them and they will abandon them over time. And on the flip side, my hope is that if there are outfits news ventures that are intellectually honest, rigorous, careful, and have balance, and I don't mean being disinterested in having views, but I mean being open to other sides and to see the weaknesses in their own arguments. My hope would be that those would be the kinds of news organizations that people will gravitate to, whether they're in the traditional form or on the Internet.
We've got about 30 seconds left, and I don't want to introduce a new topic, but what's the primary conclusion that you reach in your book, if you could just give us that in about 30 seconds?
The primary conclusion that I hope people will take away is that journalism is vital to our ability to thrive as a society, but that it is undergoing dramatic changes, and that it's important as citizens that we understand the changes that are going on and that we play a role in figuring out where we go.
Thank you so much. Scott, was a wonderful hour. I really enjoyed talking with you, and I hope to finish the rest of your book this weekend.
Thank you for having me on.
Scott Gant, a partner in Boies, Schiller & Flexner in Washington, D.C., where he practices constitutional and media law, former counsel for the New Republic, and author of We Are All Journalists Now, published by Free Press. This program was produced by Carmen Jackson with on-air production by Leo Duran. It is program number 613C, as in cat, 613C, and it's available for you, if you want to buy a copy of it at the radio store, 800-747-7444. I think I'm going to start a radical moderate blog. I'm John Munson, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.